Welcome to a new episode of Software Gone Wild, this week with a hefty dose of real-life network programmability. I'm Ivan Pipelniak, you might know me from my blog at ibspace.net, and my co-host Matt Stone is back from the Cloudy Heights. And Matt, you tell people why I'm teasing you about the Cloudy Heights.
That's just because of our last show, probably, and some of the stupid stuff I said on that. But no, we're still trying to get all this cloud stuff figured out. And I think one of the things that's going to help us is some of these tools and stuff that's coming down the pipeline. So I'm anxious to get into today's show to try and talk about some of that stuff that's going to help enable us to write the applications that are going to help orchestrate some of that stuff.
Oh, and that's a perfect lead in. Thank you. Today's guest is Jeremy Schulman, author of, among other things, Juno's EasyNC Library, and founder of Sprockets. Did I get that right?
That's exactly right. Thank you, Ivan.
So how are you doing today, Jeremy?
Fantastic. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having the time. I'm positive that most people that are in this area know who you are and what you were doing. For the newcomers, do tell us a bit about your history and how you stumbled upon the network programmability and what you were doing at Juniper.
Sure. Thank you. So my name is Jeremy Schulman. I've been in networking my entire career, which spans about 20 years. And I first got into the networking business as a software engineer for about 10 years. And then 10 years into it, I switched gears and became a systems solution architect and then did some business development. For the past 6 years, I've been at Juniper Networks, and in the last 3 years, I've been exclusively focused on network programmability, and in particular, looking at ways in which we can adapt and learn from the DevOps tool chains, methodologies, culture, and community, and apply them to the networking community.
So you were probably heavily involved when Juniper created a puppet agent for Junos, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I was in the center of that, and I was responsible for actually writing all of the code. So that included the Ruby agent code for adapting the Junos configuration elements into the puppet agent, as well as writing the netconf library that is part of Ruby now. So yeah, very intimately familiar with producing the Ruby agents, both for Puppet, and then it later became the work that went into the chef support that we have at Juniper.
By the way, how far did you get with the Puppet agent? When I looked at it, it was able to provision VLANs, and that was more or less it.
That's right. So what we have to kind of go back in history was, why did we do it, right? We produced the Puppet support not for the networking people, actually, but it was for the server operations teams or the DevOps teams that needed to coordinate their server deployment, their application server deployments, with changes that those applications needed for the network. So those DevOps teams, if you want to call it DevOps teams, were using Puppet, and they only needed those abstractions necessary to connect the physical server needs with the server needs with the physical networking needs. So it was a tool for the DevOps. And what we learned from that experience was the NetOps community, the network engineering and operations guys, started to realize the tool chains that were available in DevOps, and they started to see the value of those tools, right? But the support that we did was specifically for things that you would think about for servers, like ports and VLANs and link aggregation and so forth.
So your customer was effectively the server team, not the networking team.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Because those teams already had sophisticated infrastructure and operations built around the Puppet tool chain. And so for those customers, they said, we are already using Puppet to manage our server infrastructure, and we need just the small amounts of control that we need to coordinate with the network. And that is all. And the networking team, who generally were very reluctant to give up any kind of control to anybody, were okay with those limited, isolated configuration changes for a couple of reasons, actually, that we can talk about if you'd like to go into detail there.
Oh, of course. Go on.
Sure. So when we look at DevOps tool chains, what I've, you know, the way I kind of break them down is that those tools like Puppet and Chef are making isolated device-oriented changes. And what I mean by that is they have a blast radius of zero, meaning if I make a change on this device, it doesn't affect other devices. And if we compare that to, say, protocols, for example, BGP or MPLS or anything that talks to something else, right? Making a change that has a blast radius greater than zero, right? Networking guys are very reluctant about, right? Because they say, well, if you change this one device, it could have really negative effects that sweep across my network. And, you know, we don't want to take down the network, so you can't do that. But the types of changes that they would allow were the same types of changes that those tool chains were going after, which were blast radius zero. So they were okay with that for one thing. And the second thing is that, in particular, Junos had some very nice controls at a user class level that they could isolate the user that was making the change so that they couldn't, you know, inflict changes into other elements of the configuration. So they were very happy about those two things.
So you were using role-based access control to effectively allow that particular user that the Puppet server used to log into the routers to, for example, only create VLANs.
Correct. That's exactly correct.
And so the networking people said, well, okay, now that we know that this user has limited access to the configuration, we're okay with that.
Yep. They said, we're okay because the user has limited access to the configuration and the things that they want to configure have a blast radius of zero.
Were you also able to limit the ports that this agent could touch? Because, for example, if you would only limit the VLANs, then in theory, that agent could touch the uplinks and shut down the uplinks or remove VLANs on uplinks or whatever crazy stuff.
Well, that's very possible. I think that we didn't really go down that path because it wasn't necessary, but, you know, for some of the customers that we were talking to. But Junos does provide that level of sophistication in role-based access control. So it was possible. We just hadn't implemented it.
So was your work with the API kind of a natural progression of that then? Was it kind of like more geared towards the DevOps style way of doing things? Because it seems, at least from my perspective, the kind of library and stuff that you had created for Junos, from my perspective, seems to be geared more generally, but at the same time would more readily be consumed by a DevOps team than it would be like a NetOps team.
You know, that's an interesting question. So let me break it down into kind of two, I'll break it down the way I'd answer that. What we built as part of the Ruby library that was independent of Puppet, we modeled the resources in an idempotent manner, right? So that was a technique that we learned from DevOps, meaning I want to model a resource like a VLAN or a port or a link aggregation group. And we modeled it in terms of properties, right? So that you could say, I want to set this property on this resource. And if that property was already set, then no change occurred. And if there was a change, it would perform that change and report back, which is kind of the model of these DevOps tools. This concept of idempotency is part of their vernacular. Okay. So does that term make sense, or should I try to re-explain that?
Well, Jeremy, maybe just for people who have never heard that term, it effectively means that you can do the same request 10 times, and the first time it will execute, and the other 9 times it will go like, okay, we already did that.
That's right. And that's very important because what it allows infrastructure engineers, and I'll use that term generically, to do is they can model what they want the end result to be, right? And then it doesn't matter how many times they run it. So they can say, as a batch process, run a process every hour and only changes that need to be made are made, right? And that's kind of the model of Puppet, for example, right? Okay. So Matt, that's part of the architecture of what we did in the library. And then in terms of, did that answer your question in its entirety, or is there some other part of your question that I missed?
Well, I guess the heart of what I'm getting at is like, how do you draw the distinction between NetOps and DevOps kind of deal? Because traditional NetOps doesn't include a development lifecycle usually. How do you draw the distinctions there? Because a DevOps environment traditionally does have a development cycle. And so I guess is your kind of future vision of that where the NetOps team would adopt some sort of development cycle? And what I mean by that development cycle is software development cycle.
Yeah, fantastic question. So, you know, since I was a developer a long time ago, right, and now putting that hat back on, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the lifecycle management of software, right? You know, build, compile, test, QA, production, that kind of thing. If you look at what is quote unquote DevOps, at least to me, right? Because everybody will define it differently. But really what you have are two groups of people, developers and operations guys, right? And the problem that they were trying to really solve is how do we get the developer applications, you know, on net in a repeatable, reliable, low risk, high velocity way, right? That was the goal, right? You know, there, you know, some people will say there's no such thing as, you know, a DevOps engineer or a DevOps team. Really, it's a set of ideas, methodologies, a cultural, you know, community, but it applies, as you said, Matt, the software design lifecycle principles, right? You know, the idea of continuous integration or automated testing and things of that nature, modeling things as software, right? So when we have developers, right, and we have operations guys, and we look at that pipeline of activity, we'll refer to that as DevOps, right? Mm-hmm. So we're okay with that. And in the DevOps tool chain, there are many tools that the operations guys, and I'm going to say it this way, there are many tools that the operations teams use in that pipeline, some of which are configuration management tools. And of those, we're talking about Puppet, Chef, Salt, and Ansible, right? But there are many other tools in the operations tool chain, right? But here's the thing that a lot of people might miss. The developers also have their own set of tool chains that is respective to their applications. Okay. And Matt, I'm going to answer your question, but I have a very long-winded storytelling kind of style. I have grandpa styles. So,
fun.
Yeah. So the real big difference in my head between operations guys and developers is this concept around blast radius. Okay. Operations guys work with technologies that have a blast radius of zero, right? In terms of I'm standing up a bunch of servers and these servers all look and smell the same way, you know, and really what they're functioning is elasticity, right? More or less of something, right? But they're more or less relative to the needs of the application. And that's where the impedance matchup has to occur between the needs of the developers and the operations teams that serve them. Okay. But a developer might say, I'm building an application and that application requires MySQL version, you know, 5.5. So, hey, Mr. Operations guys, I need you to build, you know, 10,000 servers with that, you know, that version of MySQL and the MySQL config file that represents, you know, the needs of my application from a tuning and performance. But what the operations guys doesn't do is they don't define the database schema. They don't load the data into the database. They don't transmorgify the data in the database. Who does that? That's the application guys, right? So operations guys use tools that have a blast radius of zero, and developers who build, you know, essentially a scalable, distributed applications as a whole, right? You know, web, app, database, whatever tiering that they've got, they use different tools. So their tools have a blast radius of greater than one, right? Because it's a distributed application.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept of blast radius, I like to use this term, blast radius, is very important. Now, going to NetOps, what are NetOps in my head? NetOps are the network engineers, right? The guys who plan, design, maybe even architect, you know, the networking engineers and their operations teams. Okay, that support them. And some, you know, if it's a big organization, you obviously you've got, you know, structure. In smaller organizations, you know, you have less structure. Now, when you think about it, the role of the NetOps guys, right, they have both problems. They have blast radius of zero problems, and they have blast radius of n greater than one problem, you know, because they are effectively the developers in this model. You know, they are managing distributed multi-vendor applications. We'll call them BGP and MPLS and OSPF. They didn't write the code, but they have to manage it. They have to manage the databases associated with them. If you want to think about the config files on all the devices, and they have to manage the operational databases, like essentially all the show commands, right? So putting this all together in my head, and I'm going to, you know, make a chart and put this on my blog site. But if you imagined a 2x2 matrix, right? And on the bottom of that matrix was config and show. We'll just call it config and show, meaning there's things that you do to do configuration. There's things that you do to gather operational information. And you think of those two things at the bottom of the 2x2, and then going up the y-axis of the 2x2 is blast radius of 0, and then blast radius of greater than 0. Okay, if you imagine that little four sectional chart, configuration management tools like Puppet and Chef sit only in that config blast radius of 0. And that's all they do. Right. I mean, they're great tools. Don't get me wrong. They're awesome tools. They're fantastic tools. But
intended for a specific purpose, right? So that the blast radius of 0 thing works for a server. It doesn't necessarily work for a network.
That's exactly right, Matt. And that's why, as we started to explore those tools more and more, and then trying to map, can we use those tools in networking? The answer was not really. I mean, for very specific cases, if you were trying to perform configuration management for scenarios that had a blast radius of 0, they worked pretty well. So, you know, there was all of this focus on the megascale data center. And in that case, that was a really big problem, right? But that's about it, right? It doesn't handle all of the other 75% of the problem for NetOps. And especially if you do anything like WAN or campus or, you know, all the other bits and pieces of network security. And then you get into the multi-vendor nature of things and different types of devices of things. And then you get into the complexity of not only do we have the networking devices themselves, but we now have virtualized technologies, the overlay systems like OpenContrail from Juniper and Nuage or NSX, you know, those types of overlay technologies. And then, then it even gets worse. And then you have to deal with the cloud, right? Because cloud networking, like, say, for example, setting up IPsec tunnels between the cloud and, say, a physical firewall on-prem, right? Those types of things, you know, they're just, okay, the server guys just assume they have these things up and running, these communication channels, before they can deploy their servers up into the cloud. So now if you look at the problem that the NetApp guys have, the world that we live in, this evolving world of networking is so hard. And I'm not saying that because fear, uncertainty, doubt kind of stuff. I'm just saying, if you are looking at this landscape, as I am very intimately, because this is all I do with Sprockets, and I look at all of the vendors and all of their APIs, and then all of the virtualized technologies and all of their APIs, and all the cloud networking technologies and all their APIs, I'm like, wow, that's a really hard problem if you want to apply network automation to. And that's the problem set that Sprockets is looking to solve.
Let me just throw another dimension at your graph. If I sort of understand correctly, most of these configuration management tools, they could, in theory, handle configuration management, but they are usually used to build something from scratch. Is that understanding sort of correct?
Well, so not exactly. I mean, for the purposes of what they do, yes, right? You know, that's what they were designed to do. And it depends really what you mean by scratch, you know, honestly.
I mean, well, you know what I mean. Hey, Puppet, build me a server.
Yeah, but it doesn't really build you a server. What it says is, hey, server, I want you to have these packages of software installed. And so it depends what you mean by scratch. But let's kind of roll this to our audience, the networking guys. We said, what if we want to stand up new equipment, you know, from scratch, you know, out of the box, factory, blah, blah, blah. Notwithstanding, you know, getting it online. If I wanted to produce my, we'll call it our infrastructure config, meaning the base configuration file that represented, you know, the day one config before we started layering on services, what we would call networking services, right? Mm-hmm. So there is standing up new equipment, or what I like to call building a house, right? Versus the lifecycle management of the network, meaning adding services or changing elements. You know, you and I would call that move, adds, and changes, right? You know, when I look at networking, we have both of those problems. We need to solve both of those problems. And then the management and construction of those elements are very different, right? For example, if we wanted to stand up new kit, I don't think we want to model every single widget in a configuration file. We just want to say, here's a golden template of config. You know, splat that out, stick it on a box, power it up, it's good to go, right?
Yeah, and that's what Puppet and Ansible and things like that are really good at.
Sort of. I mean, I would say, you know, because I've adapted Ansible to do that, right? And we used Ansible specifically for that purpose. We said, when we want to stand up new equipment, you know, it's great for doing template building and then pushing a complete or configuration file to a device, and there you go. But that doesn't give you the idempotent widget modeling. That just says, here's an opaque containment of data, you know, put it on the box. There you go. It doesn't allow you to do that idempotently, right? Because, you know, it just doesn't. So people have the need of doing both, you know, splatting some config on a box and then lifecycle managing it idempotently. You know, the really big problem that I hear over and over again is like firewall ACL management rules, right? You know, just.
Oh, don't even go there.
Yeah, but I have to.
Yeah, I know.
I have. And, you know, so with Sprockets, we can, you know, we can idempotently manage firewall policies. I mean, you can describe your policies as a YAML structure, and then it will idempotently ensure that what you want actually exists and only make changes when it's necessary. But to start to stand up, like say a data center SRX firewall, you know, the Juniper product, for example, you know, you're going to say, here's the splat of the config that has all the infrastructure, you know, bells and whistles that you need to get that up, gear up and running. But the lifecycle management of the policies and the address books and all that, that you want to do idempotently. And a tool like Ansible doesn't really do that well for networking, actually at all. In particular for Juniper Kit. You know, we try to look at these different tools to say, well, can we apply these tools to networking? And yes, there are some, you know, some elements, like Matt says, where you can apply them in a very specifically niche way, but they don't really solve that, you know, that those all four blocks of that, that 2x2 matrix that I talk about. And in particular, where those configuration management tools don't work, you know, for networking is they're not the show part of that matrix at all. You know, those tools don't, you know, are not designed to extract information, especially from a distributed environment or a multi-vendor environment, and use that ephemeral state or the running state of systems in concert with maybe even doing more config. So when you look at a lot of the processes that networking guys have, like do a show command, do a bunch of show commands, or do a little bit of config, now do some more show commands, now do more some more config, and that kind of workflow pattern, you know, configuration management tools with a blast radius of zero were not designed for that type of workflow pattern.
Absolutely true. Now, you mentioned Sprockets a number of times. What is it?
So Sprockets is my new venture. You know, I left Juniper about 2 months ago. And what I wanted to do was build an automation tool for networking that solved those four corners or that whole matrix holistically, and take the best parts that I learned from Puppet and Chef and Ansible and Salt and bring those design elements to networking and solve the really hard problem, what I call the architecture of disagreement problem, which is everybody is doing things differently, right? You know, if you looked at the APIs from Cisco, Juniper, you know, all the guys, you know, Arista, whatever, all of our APIs are different. You know, some people use REST, some people use XML, some people use both, you know, some people, you know, it's really all over the board.
Some people use CLI encapsulated in XML.
Some people do that. Some people have no API at all. And, you know, that's what we refer to as screen scraping. So, you know, there is this, you know, there's this disparate nature of networking, right? And we can't assume or even expect that the networking guys are all going to get together and agree on this stuff. You know, when somebody says, well, if we could just agree on the northbound APIs, we could all move forward as a community. And I think that's a laudable idea, but I'm not going to wait for that. You know, I've been in networking for 20 years. So
yeah, we've seen how well that worked with SQL.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was about to say, like, name me one other part of computer science where that's happened.
Yeah. Now, it's funny is because we in networking, we have this DNA inside of us that says we must agree. And this is because we grew up in the IETF and the RFCs, and we're talking about control plane protocols. Control plane protocols we have to agree on because it's a distributed application, right? You know,
sure.
BGP,
sure.
OSPF. And so, you know, the first thing that we all want to do, because this is just that our nature, is to say, well, let's form a committee and let's all agree on this is how it's supposed to work, because we believe that if we all agree, then it'll all be copacetic. But that's never been true with management plane, right? You know, management plane has always been different, has always been the point of disagreement. And in fact, has generally been the point of, you know, where a vendor says, well, we're better than somebody else. You know, our CLI is better, or our SNMP support is better, or our NetComp support is better, or whatever you might want to say. That management plane has generally been a point of, you know, vast difference, right? So Sprockets is meant to do configuration management, operational management, you know, troubleshooting, auditing, reporting, logging, but not like syslogging, but, you know, the ability to extract complex data out of the network and do it in a way that doesn't require networking people to be sophisticated formal language programmers. So taking the concepts of YAML-based workflow syntax, like what I've seen from Ansible, I really like that style. And when we were using it at Juniper to do some of our work, people really gravitated on it. They said, this is something that we can understand. We have a lot of visibility into. We understand the steps that it's taking, you know, do this, then do this, then do this. So that ordered set of instruction done at a high level, people like that better than, say, some of the graph theory, goal-oriented natures of, say, what we were doing with Puppet, where you just kind of have, you describe things with a dependency graph, and then the system just kind of figures it out. You know, there's that element of magic that a lot of people, you know, that are not attuned to that model are not comfortable with. You know, there's always this measure of trust, guys. You know, with the networking people, it's like, if it's new, you know, mm-hmm. you know, how much do we want to trust it, right?
Oh, by the way, that brings me to another question I wanted to ask you when we were discussing Puppet on Junos. How did you persuade the networking guys that all this zillion of changes won't crash the box?
Well, you know, in Junos, the way that changes are made is through the Junos API. Okay, so when you're on a Junos box and you're typing CLI commands, it's actually going through a Junos API. It's, you know, it's all going through the same kind of code base, right? The same thing. The CLI is really just a human rendering engine on top of the API. Right. Uh-huh. And the Puppet agent was using that same exact API. Okay. So, you know, the fact is whether you're typing the commands manually on a CLI or you're automating them through the NetConf API, it's the same, you know, processing. It's the same work effort of processing. The real question came in, you know, how much memory does the foreign agent require, right? The Puppet agent. It wasn't really so much as a processing function. It's more of a memory footprint that really what we ran into, you know. So some systems, you know, some large systems have, you know, 4 gigs of memory, and some smaller systems have, you know, 1 gig of memory. And then the processing model in an operating system will control and limit how much memory you can actually use. So with Junos, they had an SDK that allowed you to constrain how much memory a process can use and control its, you know, resource consumption. So in Junos, that was easy to do because it's, you know, all based on FreeBSD, and the system allowed for that.
So you could limit how much memory the Ruby interpreter would get, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and if the Ruby interpreter crashed for whatever reason or something bad happened, yeah, it's a Unix environment, so it's isolated. And what was nice about, you know, the Junos NetConf API is if there was a transaction in process, think of it like a database transaction, and it got clobbered in the middle, Junos automatically, you know, rolls back that and discards. So there's a lot of really nice fail-safe mechanisms that are part of Junos that lend itself very, very well to these types of systems, not just, you know, Puppet or Chef, but, you know, any kind of automated management systems.
Okay, but coming back to Sprockets, sorry for the excursion down the rabbit hole. How far along are you? When can we see the product?
So I'm actually doing demonstrations now to early customers. So the product is pretty far along, actually. It does configuration changes, audit reporting, and so forth for a number of vendors today. And it's really quite far along. So I'm very excited about the progress. And I'm actually looking to go into some early lab environments within the next few weeks.
So when you mention multiple vendors, are you willing to throw any names out in the wild?
Sure. So I've got, in Sprocket's lingo, I call them integrations, right? And an integration, what an integration really represents is the connector which is the piece of code that communicates over the vendor provided API or the vendor specified API. And then the set of actions that do things, right? So for example, for Junos, I have a Junos integration that will do all of the tables and views mechanisms, SRX policy management, and then just kind of the generic push a config file mechanisms that we've seen, like say in Ansible, and some other bits and pieces. The other integrations that I've got going on is with Arista, Cisco, Amazon Web Services for the virtual private cloud. I'm working on some stuff with Citrix Nitro, and there's a few others. OVS, you know, Open vSwitch. I've been approached to do an integration with the OVSDB protocol. So, in the not too distant future, Sprockets allows for polymorphic actions, which means even if Arista and Juniper and Cisco all have a unique action about how to manage a VLAN, Sprockets has a way to synthesize those things together so that you can just have a generic thing called VLAN and then manage them uniformly in what I would call a workbook. So the types of type and provider mechanism that we saw in Puppet, which I really, really liked and really lent itself well for a multi-vendor environment, I brought that idea and concept into Sprockets.
Nice.
Yep, yeah. So if there are folks out there that want to start, you know, taking a look at it, you know, I welcome the opportunity to do some demos. I'm in the process of making some video demos so that people can watch them, you know, like short 3 to 5 minute video demos. You know, but Sprockets is, you know, a one-man startup at this moment in time. You know, I'm still in the early stages where I'm getting enough of the MVP together, and hopefully soon I'll be putting together a small team so that we can, you know, grow the support and bring it to market in a really nice way.
So can you draw some parallels to maybe some existing DevOps tools so I can get a feel for kind of just in my mind's eye how you envision people interacting with Sprockets? So like, does it act kind of like Ansible? Does it act kind of like Puppet? Is it completely different than both of those? How do you envision people interacting with it, both programmatically and then for the traditional engineer who might not have much programming chops?
Sure. So it looks and smells a lot like Ansible, you know, in the okay. sense that it's a YAML-based syntax, and it's a directed workflow, meaning, you know, there are, you know, I call them activities. So a workbook is a collection of activities. Ansible would say they've got a playbook that is a collection of plays. And many of the fundamental concepts and ideas, I think, lend themselves very, very well. So I brought them to Sprockets, the idea of an inventory, for example. You know, so you can declare, this is the set of things, of hosts that I want to manipulate them on. You know, like, so that's my inventory. But I've kind of augmented the inventory idea for networking so that we have this concept of roles and groups. So, you know, in networking, we have functional roles, and we also have logical groups. You know, so I kind of augmented, you know, some of these ideas and adapted them for networking. And by and large, the one thing that I did first with Sprockets is I made template building kind of like a no-brainer, right? You know, how can we solve the problem of just template building configs? Let's say you don't even automate the push of those configs. You just want to say, I've got a bunch of templates that I have in my environment, and I have a bunch of data. And I want to smush those things together to get an end result so that I could manually, you know, copy and paste or push that config change, right? That's day one kind of work, right? I'm sure most people out there today, you know, have a bunch of, you know, sample configs or templates perhaps, or maybe they have a whole bunch of samples and they wish they could put them into templates, but they don't want to because now they have to write a lot of code to make it all work together. The first thing that I did with Sprockets was make that process like as simple as possible for networking guys so they can say, I want to go on the journey of template building my configs, but I just want to put my variables in these directories, I want to put my templates in these directories, and I want to write like two lines of workbook and then just say, make it happen together. And that is that works today holistically. So even if you're not talking to any devices whatsoever, right, there's no integrations, some of the core actions of Sprockets, like template building, has been optimized for networking use cases and patterns.
Okay.
Now, you've been mentioning YAML a lot, and I know what it is, but some of the listeners may not. So what is YAML?
Great. Yeah, absolutely. So YAML is a text file format that allows you to define structured data. So if you're familiar with JSON, right? JSON is not as humanly consumable, right? A lot of people, you wouldn't write JSON files, but YAML is a text-based structured language that allows you to define, lists and hash tables and scalar variables, simple variables like name equals Jeremy or age equals, well, old. And, and a lot of the DevOps tools use YAML, for two reasons. One, it's very, very simple and very, very easy to look at. You look at it and you immediately can visually see the structure and relationship of data within other data. But more importantly, you can version control things. You can check these files in and version control them. So Matt, going back to one of your earlier questions of will NetOps, start to apply DevOps methodologies, I really believe they will, like the idea of version controlling their infrastructure configs, like YAML, YAML data files, would be something they could version control. Templates, right? Jinja-based templates or templates is something that they could version control. So the idea of being able to version control, track, and audit, and then put these things into a pipeline of continuous integration is, quote-unquote, DevOps, best practices. But the kicker is this, and this is what I'm all about, is until we have tools that enable NetOps to do those things, they can't begin to apply those methodologies. You can't say, well, I want to version control my data and my templates so that, I have some process here, unless they have a tool that lets them use the data and the templates. So there's this chicken and egg. This is really what it is. There was a chicken and egg problem that said, we can't really start using these things holistically in networking until we have tools that allow us to do so. And that's why I started Sprockets.
Going back to the YAML format for a second. So if I understand correctly, when you said you can visualize how data fits together hierarchically, it's done by indenting text by a fixed amount, right?
That is correct. Yeah. YAML is an indented, yes, it is an indented formatting syntax. That is correct.
So for everyone who has ever seen Cisco IOS config, that would be a YAML file.
Well, you could make the analogy. You can say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you can
it's
say
not
that
precise.
That is correct.
Let's just say if you've been using Cisco IOS, you wouldn't be surprised when you would see the YAML file. It's not like going from Cisco IOS to Junos with all those curly brackets.
Again, you're making an analogy. The way I look at a config file is somebody can visually look at a config file and they can understand relationship of data between each piece because of its indentation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, if somebody looked at a YAML file and they were to see the orientation of the data, they go, okay, I can see that, this is a list that sits under this variable name, or this is a dictionary of key value pairs. What we were challenged by with XML was that XML is too hard to deal with, right? First, it's hard to write, it's hard to read, and more importantly, it's really hard to process. If you're writing a program and your data is in XML, and again, all XML is a text file of structured data, just like HTML, right? But in order to extract the information out of that data, there's a lot of programming that you have to do. You have to write a lot of code to extract what you want.
Well, I would just say that you have wrong libraries, but okay, let's not go there.
Well, let's revisit that one in a minute. But with YAML and JSON, what makes people like YAML and JSON is they can say, take this file, load it into my program, and I can immediately use it, in native programming constructs like a list or a hash, right? But you can't do that with XML. You say,
oh, you can. In Perl, you have XML in. Bam,
yeah.
You're done.
Yes, if you're using these types of libraries. But you're getting on to another topic that...
Yeah, I know. That's not good there.
Yeah. Okay. So
anyway,
was that enough on your YAML question?
Back to Sprockets.
Sure.
I will say parsing XML is far more fun than parsing, say, like just a regular screen scrape.
Yeah, anytime you have structured data, it's better than unstructured data. And not to go on a small rant because I'll keep it short, but this is why the unstructured data problem is why we have not had really good networking automation tools, because with unstructured data and then variance in release, the task of keeping up with that, you know, keeping up with the task of just automating your system, supporting the system that you had to write was overbearing, and in most cases not worth it. So that's why we don't really see a lot of really good tools there using the screen scraping method.
Totally agree. Anyway, coming back to Sprockets, what's your commercial model? Will this be open source with commercial support, or will this be open source based with for pay extensions, or will this be a commercial product? How do you plan to bring this to the market?
That's a really good question, and I haven't come to any, you know, specific conclusions, and I probably won't until I have a set of investors and a business guy and so forth. But I'll kind of give you where I'm thinking, right? I'll give you some philosophies that I have. Will there be a community-based kind of model to this kind of thing? Absolutely. I mean, I'm very much about building a community around contribution and sharing and things of that nature. So that is kind of a core element. So there will be kind of a community model. They will probably, you know, I don't want to say there will be, but there will probably be a similar business model that you find with the other tool chains, where there some of it is a commercial and some of it is free. You know, when I think about the networking community, you know, our the people that operate and manage networks and plan them, my experience has been most of them, when they ask the question, is it open source? They're really asking the question, is it free? Not so much, is it code I want to, you know, play or tinker with? Now, there are some that, you know, want to look at the code because they want to learn. There's some people that want the code for, we'll call it, insurance reasons, like, you know, it's Friday afternoon and I need to make some change for the weekend. I think there's a big spectrum of people who actually care about the code and why. But by and large, you know, the idea of giving somebody a free tool, right, versus I have to pay $1 million for a tool is more, you know, in the forefront of people's mind. So I need to balance all of those things because I'm not independently wealthy. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't come from money. I don't have like $5 million sitting in a bank account that lets me just do things for free. But I do want to find a nice balance for our community and the way our community can contribute. So that is the process of figuring it out. And the customers that I talked to early on, I think will help to shape that answer. Was that dodging it enough?
No, that was fine.
Yeah.
I totally understand where you are in the process and why you can't give a more definitive one.
Yeah. But what I am doing is for early adopter partner type of people that want to explore and try out the code and play with it, you know, I am in a mode where, you know, those commercial arrangements can be made. So, you know, if there's a, you know, there are partners out there that want to use the Sprockets technology, even where it is today, as part of an OEM solution, or even integrators that want to use this technology as a way in which they're going to serve their own customers. Like, you know, there are tons and tons of integrators out there that, you know, all they do is template build configs or set up configs and set up equipment for their customers. You know, setting up commercial agreements with those guys right now is very doable, you know, without having to like put all the source into GitHub at the moment.
By the way, now that you mentioned commercial products, one other product that looks to be in more or less the same category is TailF's, well, now Cisco's NCS. So how would you compare what you're doing to what they are doing?
Yeah, fantastic question. So again, going back to that 2x2, that 2x2 matrix, you know, where config and show is at the bottom, and you know, going up the y-axis, you have blast radius of 0 and 1. They were predominantly focused specifically on configuration, but, you know, up the vertical axis, so they could do a multi-vendor config change, right, across many boxes, and do it in a service-oriented way, right? What they didn't have at the time was the ability to extract the ephemeral state data across the network in a way that, you know, express that out to the customer. So, for example, you might say, I want to provision these VLANs on a set of boxes, or I might want to create a MPLS circuit across the set of boxes using Yang as a modeling language and device adapters that they wrote. It was really a config management tool. It was not a what I would call a ephemeral state auditing or data collection tool. But since it got bought by Cisco, you know, we don't know its future. I mean, I wish those guys the best. I used to work with them, you know, as peers because they were NetConf guys and Yang guys. And they had some really awesome technology. And while I was at Juniper and they were at TailF, you know, I said, hey, you know, what people really care about is thinking about the network as a database and extracting the runtime information or the ephemeral state data out, because 70% of what we do is, you know, troubleshooting, auditing, reporting, planning. You know, the config management is only one aspect. You know, would you guys consider, you know, this other spectrum of functionality? And that functionality wasn't produced, you know, in the time frame before Cisco acquired them. So, you know, I know those guys. I wish them all the best. I don't know the future of that technology at Cisco, if they're going to continue to sell it as a standalone product, if customers are even willing to buy it as a standalone product, you know.
If nothing else, I hope what we get out of it is some good NetConf knowledge at Cisco, so we can actually have a better implementation of that on the teal boxes of the world.
Oh, don't go there.
I've been there before, which is why I said that.
Indeed. You know, I do believe that this particular space of network automation is very much a growth opportunity, because, you know, we're seeing this convergence of, you know, infrastructure equipment, virtualized stuff and cloud stuff, and everything has an API. And, you know, I was watching the Network Field Day videos, and, you know, people will say, yeah, we've got an API for this, and we've got an API for that, and it's really easy to write a script to do this, and it's really easy to write a script to do that. And then somebody in the audience said, well, no, it isn't. If you're not a programmer or even have even a little bit of time to do that. So, you know, what I am seeing is that the industry is orienting around automatable infrastructure, but the execution gap, you know, is too wide for, you know, what I would call the NetApps team. So Sprockets, the whole point of Sprockets is to close that gap and give the NetOps guys the same superhuman automation skills, right, that the server guys have. You know, they just need tools that allow them to do that.
And if you can bring, so like, one of the things that bugs me and Matt Oswalt talk about this, and what's more just like kind of commiserate on it, really, people like love to say like, oh, we've got an API, we've got an API, we've got an API. And it's kind of like, okay, that's great. But even for programmers, if you don't have a library that I can consume in a language that I use, then that means I've got to serialize all the data to you. We've got to figure out how to parse the data that you're sending back. And we've got to figure out your API at a very intimate level. Nobody, even for developers, nobody wants that. Like, congratulations that you have an API that's needed, but also the next step is provide me a library so that I can actually do something useful for you. Because it's real easy to idealize this stuff and say like, oh, it's real easy to do X because they have an API. It's like, well, yeah, I guess maybe, except for you've got to write all the code just to even communicate with them before you even accomplish one thing.
Yeah, yeah, you know, you're right on the money with that. And that's really that's the key value that you'll find in Sprockets, is that all the low level, you know, vendor API specific stuff is handled by the integrations, and it exposes a set of actions, you know, well-defined actions that say, you know, that you can express in a YAML, you know, workbook, you know, do this, do this, do this. And then they don't have to know, you know, is it REST? Is it JSON? Is it XML? Is it NetConf? Is it screen scraping? You know, what is it? They don't have to worry about, you know, the how it gets done. They have to define what needs to get done. And that kind of decomposition of what and how is what I really was awesome to see, like in a system like Puppet that said, we're going to decompose the what from the how and do it in a way in which gives you this multiplexing of what the actual end target is. You know, is it Juniper, is it Cisco, is it Arista, or is it Debian versus CentOS or whatnot? So that was a really key element of the Sprockets architecture. And you're right, Matt. I mean, I am going through all these vendor APIs, and they are all over the board with how they're used and just the nuances of them and just relative maturity of things. It's just, it's really, really hard. And, you know, and I'd like to think I'm a pretty smart programmer, you know, so man, it's a lot of work that I'm kind of biting off. But I do believe that once enough gravity flywheels around something like this, we'll start to see people like, maybe even, you know, like you said, Matt Oswalt, you know, who has programming capabilities, or yourself that has programming capabilities. And then once you start showing people how these things can be done, and you give them a body of work to start from, like, let's say, you know, there's an NX API integration that says, here's how you do, you know, VLANs. And somebody says, that's great, but I want to add OSPF, right, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to optimize that gap of time, if you could wake up in the morning and go, I want to add OSPF support to my NX API stuff, and it took you an hour to do, right, would you do it, right? Versus if it took you a week to do, would you do it? You know, closing that execution gap is really where I'm trying to optimize, you know, the idea around sprockets, because there are two groups of people in my head, actually. There are the people who write workbooks who are said, you know, here is a collection of widgets that you can Lego together, right? And then there are people who actually have to write Python code to add new Legos. Mm-hmm. So depending on the environment, you may not need to add more Legos. You can use it as it is. And then there's some people that are like, no, I want to add these 5 Legos just for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe they decide to share that back to the community. Maybe they don't, you know, and that's okay. That's a business decision that they make.
I think the real question that all this comes back down to, though, for you and for me is, do you have an OpenStack demo?
Do you want an OpenStack demo?
No, I was just joking because everyone's talking about, hey, we can do OpenStack too.
great. What's interesting, you know, not to kind of lampoon that, but, you know, if you look at something like OpenStack or Open Daylight or the, you know, Cisco APIC or any kind of controller, you know, thingamabob, right? They'll say, we have an API so you don't have to point and click the GUI. I think that's great. But somebody still has to write a quote unquote, you just have to write a little script, right? Somebody has to articulate, this is what I call it. Somebody has to articulate the API in a workflow that's meaningful for you, right? At the end of the day, somebody has to do that. So I can use sprockets to articulate OpenStack. You know, I can articulate their API. I can articulate, you know, APIC API. I could articulate, you know, OpenContrail API. You know, to me, that's just an integration, right? That is an external connector. And when you look, if you were to look at what I did for the Amazon Web Service VPC, it's exactly that. It's just it's a connector that articulates, in this case, the Bato Python library to coordinate IPsec, you know, setup and teardown. And what's really cool is that once it does that, it has the data from Amazon Web Services, like your tunnel endpoint, your public IP addresses, which then you can then use that data to template build the specific firewall provisioning configs. And then maybe you stop. You say, I've got these configs and I want to manually do those onto the box. Or you can say, you know, go to Amazon, gather this data, template build the configs, push the configs to the device. And you could, you know, automate the entire workflow.
Okay, it looks like we are getting in the turtles all the way down debate. So let's stop there.
Okay.
Thank you for all this information, Jeremy. And if people want to know more about sprockets, where can we find it?
So there's a sprockets.com is sprockits.com, sprockets.com.
I'll put this in the show notes. Don't worry.
Sure. And there's a contacts page.
It's like trying to pronounce your name.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. So they're welcome to reach out through the contacts page, or they can email me directly at jeremy.schulman@sprockets.com.
You blogging there? Will you publish any information as you progress? So what's your, let's say, information dissemination plan?
Yeah. So there is basically, there's a blog page where I am blogging on a somewhat regular basis, but not as regular as I would like. But yes, that's where I am blogging. I'm also going to be presenting at Interop in New York, September 30th and October 1st for anybody that's going to be in New York. And I'm very happy to engage with folks that have questions. I really appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Perfect. Thank you. And Matt, what are your plans? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm, as always, at bighamstone.com and then on Twitter at bighamstone. And you can find me there at those places and then hopefully a little bit more frequently on this podcast.
Oh, and you have this new cloud company, so let's plug that in.
Yeah, so we're hopefully might even be using some of the Sprocket stuff. It seems pretty cool to orchestrate some of our networking stuff. But you can find us at stratusplex.com. We're a turnkey infrastructure as a service / desktop as a service provider. So
perfect. And I'm Ivan Pieperniak, and usually you can find me somewhere close to ipspace.net and occasionally tweeting as at iOS Hints. I mentioned today's show notes, and they will be at podcast.ipspace.net, where there's also a subscribe link on the right-hand side, if you hopefully want to subscribe to the podcast. You need more information on SDN, I have a whole page just with links to other SDN resources at ipspace.net/SDN, and in there you'll find the SDN-related podcasts like this one, webinars, workshops, consulting services. So everything you need to get your SDN project off the ground. And if you need a hefty dose of reality, I just released a book which deals with how overhyped SDN is and what you might encounter if you plan to go down the OpenFlow path. Finally, If you like the show, please tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to follow us at podcast.ibspace.net.